Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Adask, and this is the American Independence Hour. Or excuse me, it's not the American Independence Hour. It's Financial Survival. I get to talking to myself. I'll remember my own name, and I'll remember James Corbett's name. James is the publisher and intellectual force behind the Corbett Report, which you can find on the internet. James is located in Japan. He's been there for a decade or 11 years now, I guess. And we're going to talk and see what James thinks is happening in the world today. Hello, James. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well, Alfred, and good to talk to you again. Thank you again for allowing me to turn the tables on you last week. I think my audience quite enjoyed getting to know you.
Well, you know, I actually got a couple of... I was contacted by a couple of members of your audience, and they were interested in one thing or another. And I didn't realize that you were going to essentially tape that portion of the program and rebroadcast it as one of your own broadcasts. And I thought it was just,
I don't know if you know, but I do that every week. So my audience does actually know this program pretty well by now.
Well, that's good. That's good. I certainly have no objection. I mean, I'm trying to get information out, and I'm not very particular how it gets out, just so long as it does. So
well, speaking of getting information out, one point from last week that I think I should bring up is that a listener pointed out that Brian sent me an email with a link to Health Canada's website, where under the drug product database, they have a definition under active ingredient, which says... Can you guess? An active ingredient is any component that has medicinal properties and supplies pharmacological activity, blah, 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 that affect the structure or any function of the body of man or other animals. So it is not just the FDA.
Yeah. No. See, we've had people contact me from England and also either Australia or New Zealand. I never remember which one it was. This goes back several years ago. They looked into their own drug laws. And I have not confirmed this for myself, but they told me that the English definition of drugs and the Australian or New Zealand, whichever it was, definition of drugs also is written in terms of defining man as an animal. I regard this as evidence that this is a fundamental plank, perhaps a cornerstone for the New World Order. We've laughed and joked for years about being just livestock on the global plantation. But we thought it was just a joke. We thought it was, maybe it's the truth. The fundamental premise for the New World Order is that all the people out there are nothing but animals and therefore livestock. And ultimately, they have no more rights than a chicken in a Tyson processing plant. And so this is an extraordinary story. We found, what did I find? Something like 24 different definitions that applied in the case we were working on, that I was involved in, at both the Texas level and the federal level, where the definitions were man or other animals or animals other than man, which meant the same thing. This isn't a fluke. This is something. And did I explain to you that this was genocide? This constitutes an act of genocide?
No, but I see how that does constitute genocide.
Well, in fact, you can go to an entity called genocidewatch.org, and they've got a document on their website entitled 8 Stages of Genocide. And the third step in those 8
yes,
stages...
Yes, dehumanizing, right, yes.
Dehumanization, right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Where they call people, animals, insects, vermin, and you dehumanize them and thereby render them fit for slaughter. In slaughter once you've gone. And Adolf Hitler in 1935, Nuremberg Laws. You can find this yourself, 1935 Nuremberg Laws. You can scroll through them and you'll find where he declared the Jews to be Untermenschen, meaning subhuman, animals. And that laid the foundation for concentration camps and genocide and whatever took place there. Right? Legally, it was okay to kill the Jews because they were just animals. Our government has been running that in this country since 1906, Pure Food and Drug Act. So it's an extraordinary story, and it's one of those things where one of these days people are going to pay attention to the story, and it'll gain traction, and perhaps it'll make a difference. We'll watch and see. But let's get on with James Corbett. And I've got a, what am I going to start with? You did an article recently, the BBC Exposed, on the Corbett Report. And you are critical of the BBC. And why don't you tell us a little bit about what your thoughts are on the BBC in particular, and perhaps mass media in general?
Well, you caught me off guard with that one. That was a podcast that I did about 2 years ago, so I'm not, I don't have my notes in front of me.
I thought it was recent.
Don't believe so. It's been, I think it was 2013. Yes, it was January of 2013.
Well, it might be, but it showed up on YouTube and it said published April 10th, 2015. So I assume
interesting.
It was.
Wow, someone must have reposted it for me. Well,
all right.
At any rate, no, but I would say, just generally speaking, that the BBC has been embroiled in scandals many, many, many times over the years, which should not be a surprise to anyone who follows any mainstream media outlet, I would say, in this day and age. But it's particularly bad in the case of the BBC, because for people in the United States who don't know, the British Broadcasting Corporation is a, I don't want to say state monopoly. Monopoly isn't the right word, but it's basically enforced by the state that if you have a TV or radio that is capable of picking up the BBC signals, then you are obligated, according to the government, to pay a license fee. They call it a license fee. Basically, all it is a tax that forces you to pay for the state broadcaster, which, of course, people generally wouldn't pay unless they were being forced to, quote unquote. So a lot of people, of course, lie and try to evade when the collectors come around, but unfortunately a lot of people do pay their money to it. So it's one of those situations where if it was just propaganda that was just being broadcast and you could tune it out, that's one thing. But if it's propaganda that you were being forced with the threat of fines or even jail time, if you don't help to fund into existence, I think that's something else entirely. And of course, the BBC runs on a royal charter, so it obviously has inbuilt biases. And I think the problems, the endemic problems at the BBC, are perhaps best encapsulated in the Jimmy Savile story that we saw unfold, where, of course, the Jimmy Savile, a broadcaster made famous and coddled by the BBC for decades, even though it was well known behind the scenes that he had his disgusting predilections, and turned out to be not only a pedophile, but apparently a necrophiliac. And again, you can't make this stuff up. He was a sick individual. And again, this was well known behind the scenes, but to a number of people in the BBC and around that milieu.
But as long as he was making money.
Unfortunately, or making headlines and being and of course also advising Prince Charles. He was very good friends with Prince Charles, and Prince Charles even admitted he turned to him for advice from time to time on various issues.
Kind of a spiritual advisor. You know, the idea that the English would be forced to pay to listen to propaganda, that's a little adding insult to injury. It reminds me of A Clockwork Orange. I don't know if you saw that movie. But the protagonist in the film is really kind of a gangster and a thug, but they catch him and they make him watch certain movies and the rest of that sort of thing. Hold his eyes. Government catches him, forces his eyelids open so he can't turn away, and he has to see the movies they show him that make him abhor violence. Prior to that, he'd like violence, and they're trying to make him abhor. In any case, let me think of this guy not only being forced to watch these violent movies, but also pay. Right? You've got to pay to watch these movies. Insult to injury.
It's like what if else? You are executed and your family has to pay for the bullets.
That's China, isn't that true?
I believe that's true. That's what I've heard anyway.
I've heard the same sort of story. Here's something from Japan. Japan to earmark $100 billion for Asian infrastructure. This is a report from Yahoo News, originally from AFP. And apparently Japan is trying to set up a bank similar to the AIIB, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, that's being established by China. Is Japan trying to compete with China in this regard?
You know, that's interesting. I hadn't even seen that story. So that is a very interesting development. It sounds obviously like there is some sort of competition for the AIIB that's going on. But that's an interesting development, because I think fundamentally what the AIIB is about is the fact that China, with obviously a net capital account surplus because of its export-based economy, has for years been wondering what to do with its reserves. Obviously, it can't bring that money back into the country, because that would greatly affect the domestic markets. So they have traditionally bought a lot of treasuries from the U.S. government, but after $1 trillion of treasuries that aren't doing them any good in any way and are really only doing good for the U.S. government, they have obviously curtailed their treasury purchases. So what do you do with these building reserves? Well, one way to do it is to convert it into some sort of geopolitical capital by investing in infrastructure. It sounds great. What you're really doing is you're building up your economic trading partners so that you can actually get more business for your own domestic companies. And also you're seeming to be this benevolent player on the world stage. So you kind of buy the love and affection of those around you. And that's a good way to use reserves that aren't going to help you in any other way. So I think that's
good way to get rid of them.
Yeah, exactly. Well, to do something,
to get rid of them,
to employ them.
If the stuff is going to hit the fan, you may not want those reserves.
Well, exactly right.
If there's going to be a currency reset, it may be that they turn out to be worthless anyway. So you might as well spend them and dispose of them and get what use you can before the stuff hits the
fan. While you can, exactly. And so if Japan is going along the same route, perhaps it's for similar reasons, because Japan obviously also an export, heavily export-dependent economy that has large reserves, and again has $1 trillion or so of U.S. treasuries stuffed in their reserve accounts. Again, at a certain point, there's just no reason to keep paying for the U.S. government's debt, especially as the U.S. government debt continues to grow ridiculously out of control and will now just simply be papered over by the Federal Reserve. Obviously, they're looking for something more productive. I think, again, trying to spread it around in the form of infrastructure investment is probably the best way to buy some geopolitical capital.
Do you think Japan is acting unilaterally, or do you suppose the United States is in the background saying, go get them?
Again, I don't know the specifics of this story, but I would be shocked if the United States was not in some way involved with this. I'm assuming this is going to be some sort of counter institution to the AIIB, which obviously the U.S. was kind of the big holdout on that, and trying to dissuade its partners not to join in with China on that one, and failed to do so. So it would not surprise me in the least if this is just basically a counter institution.
I spent the first segment of the program talking about Hillary Clinton before you came on, and I'm just curious, what do you think Hillary's chances are of being elected president, or even receiving the Democratic nomination? Do you think she's going to get that?
Perhaps this is wishful thinking on
follow.
Well, perhaps this is wishful thinking on my part. I actually think that we are not likely to see a Clinton-Bush primary at the end, or a presidential race at the end of the day. I don't think it's going to get to that point. Certainly Clinton is going to try, and is obviously has the sort of political base around her, has a sort of inbuilt market, if you will, in terms of women who will vote simply because it is a woman and things of that nature. And Jeb Bush obviously has his own political connections and pedigree that will help him along the way. But I really don't think that's the direction that either the people of the United States obviously want, or perhaps more importantly, the people who determine who's going to run in these elections ultimately wants. I think that a fresh face would probably be better in terms of simply being able to forward the same old Wall Street agenda. And I think the backers of these politicians probably understand this at a certain point. Maybe I'm just being hopeful, but I just don't think that that's going to really serve the interests of furthering any agenda, so I don't think it's going to happen.
I don't believe Hillary's going to get the Democratic nomination. I mean, I just got trouble coming at her and more trouble coming at her. And she's got so much to, you know, if people thought Bill had a lot to explain with Monica, in the end, Hillary's got a bunch to explain also, and I think it may be more than she can explain and hold her base together.
That's it. I mean, she has too much political baggage at this point.
Yeah.
And I think that's just a liability that the real backers of this system, the Goldman Sachs and whoever, who are traditionally the largest contributors to almost every major presidential campaign, they don't want someone with that much baggage who would themselves be the story, as it were, rather than someone like Obama.
A fresh face from perhaps in a foreign country like Kenya.
There you go. Maybe hey, why not?
Another fresh face from Kenya to come in and win the presidential sweepstakes. It's hard to say. What else have we got? We've got a minute and a half or so before we Clinton Foundation, for what it's worth, has been hit with a racketeering lawsuit. It's being waged by a guy named Larry Klayman of Freedom Watch. He's filed dozens of these in the past, and I have no indication of how many he's won, but he is suing him for racketeering. Under RICO, it alleges the former first couple and their family philanthropy traded political favors for donations or generous speaking fees for Bill Clinton and his wife. Well, his wife was the nation's Secretary of State. They were passing out favors for money, and the money went to the Clinton Foundation. That's the allegation. This is a private lawsuit. It's not the government suing them. It's a RICO suit by a private individual.
Well, if I could comment on that one, maybe it's my cynical side coming out, but I don't think there will ever be any legal ramifications for the Clintons from all of this. I think there will be political ramifications, but I doubt there will ever be a legal reckoning. If for no other reason than if we look at history and the Whitewater scandal, and we find out that a lot of the key records in the Whitewater scandal were being held in the Alfred P. Murrah building right before it blew up. I think these types of tricks are, I think the Clintons have enough up their sleeve to keep themselves out of any legal trouble.
And they know enough about other people who don't want their names mentioned, where if you blow the whistle on me, guess what? I'm just showing the pictures of you and the goat, you understand?
Exactly right. Mexican standoff.
Let's take a break for a couple of commercials, and I will be right back with James Corbett from The Corbett Report, Corbett, report.com. Please stay tuned. Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addisk. I'm here with James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. I've got an article entitled Secret Meeting in London to End Cash. All right. Interesting conspiracy theory, kind of. But economist Martin Armstrong claims there is a secret meeting to end cash set to take place in London before the end of the month involving representatives from the European Central Bank and the Federal Reserve. Armstrong is known for successfully predicting the 1987 Black Monday crash, as well as the 1998 Russian financial collapse, expressed his shock that no news outlet had reported this upcoming conference. Now, as it turns out, this conference, there are a couple of people that are making a presentation that are advocating the end of cash. And this is not a conference where they're going to eliminate cash sometime before the end of this month. That's not what they're advocating. They're going to talk about it. But what do you think about this move? All of a sudden, really just in the last, I don't think it's more than 6 weeks since people started talking. We saw the first reports, or at least I saw the first reports that I noticed about proposals to move us into a cashless society. Is that a good thing, a bad thing, a dangerous thing? What do you think?
Well, I think, again, not to commit the genetic fallacy, but we should look at the people who are promoting these ideas, and it's generally not the types of people who are on the side of people like you or me or free enterprise or anything of that sort. It's generally central bankers and people at the heads of the big institutional banks. So I think we have to be at least skeptical as to why there is this big push. And I've absolutely noticed the exact same trend that you're talking about. Again, in the last maybe 2 months, I've seen dozens of different stories popping up. And I don't know whether it's just part of that phenomenon where you start looking for something and suddenly you find it everywhere because you're now looking for it, or whether there really has been an increase in this type of chatter. But either way, there's absolutely a concerted and and developing trend, a trend that's gaining steam, an accelerating trend towards this cashless society. And of course, this isn't going to happen overnight. It's not going to happen this year, but it's something that we can see is already being aimed at. And again, I have to bring it back to one of the fundamental points as to why and how this is being brought about now, as we move into the era of not just ZIRP, zero interest rate policy. Well, what can you do that would be even, once there's nowhere to go but down and you reach zero, what can you possibly do? But you have to go negative. So we're seeing the beginning of the possibility of NERP coming to various countries around the world. And we've already seen Europe talking about that, negative interest rates. So how do you actually start to implement that? And what do you do in a negative interest rate environment when people still aren't spending to actually get them spending? Well, if the banks can actually control the ways and the times that people use their money, then they can have that kind of control over the economy, the ultimate central banker control over the economy, to basically their wishes become the laws of the land. And that can't really be instituted when people have physical paper cash that they can withdraw and store under their mattresses or what have you for a rainy day. But in an environment where it is all zeros and ones and it is all held as money in bank accounts or other institutions like that, well, suddenly you can start to do all sorts of things, and you can start to implement things that wouldn't really be possible otherwise, like giving credit for redeeming your tokens, your money, quote unquote, in this cashless economy within a certain amount of time to ensure that people spend it, you know, at the right times, or all the sorts of tricks that can be played in that way that are much easier to accomplish when it's all zeros and ones instead of actual physical cash.
Including if they don't particularly like what they read in the Corbett report, you may discover that your account doesn't function.
Absolutely.
Now where are you
going to
go?
Yeah, it can. That's part of the real nightmare of where this is leading us. And again, it's so much of this is coalescing right now, and it's being pushed by so many different places. As you mentioned, I think when we talked about this a few weeks ago, now France, I believe, as of September, is going to kick in a new law where the payments of over 1,000 euro are going to be disallowed. Cash payments of over 1,000 euros. So suddenly, it's going to be, you know, you're going to be an outlaw for trying to walk around with more than 1,000 euros. It's getting to be pretty ridiculous.
I know. It's not just getting ridiculous, it's getting dangerous. And people need to look at this and understand, look, you better fight against this, folks. It's not enough just to sit back and say, well, I'll watch it and see what happens. I'll wait and see. We are turning into an incredible police state, and this will only make it worse. And it's not going to be good for anybody. They in the article I'm reading from, or that I brought up in the first place, they mentioned that they're doing this, according to one source, in order to stop tax evasion and illegal activity. Another one says to solve the world's central bank's problem with negative interest rates, which you'd mentioned. They're not interested in solving your problems, ladies and gentlemen. They're interested in solving their problems.
Let's combine that in. If I can just combine that in with a story that's developing right now, we've just had a release of information from Greek banks showing that outflows have accelerated, reached 5 billion euros in April, daily outflows of 200 to 300 million euros from the Greek banking sector as people start withdrawing their money and trying to stash it anywhere they can that's not in Greece, because people see the writing on the wall that's going on there. Again, that's the type of thing that in a cashless society, it would be a lot easier to crack down on, and those types of outflows could be controlled, and capital controls could be instituted much more stringently.
I understand. Speaking of Greece, I saw an article today where the European Central Bank said they think they can handle it. It's not a big problem if Greece does exit from the Eurozone. Do you agree with that assessment? Or do you think... I'm inclined to think that this Greek problem is not as big as people have alleged. If the Greeks don't pay their debts, the world isn't going to come to an end. I don't believe the financial system is going to collapse. There might be a little bump in the road. I think if they exit from the, I don't know that the rest of the European Union will notice if Greece leaves. Is this really a serious problem, or has this been exaggerated?
Well, again, I'll bring it back to the point that Mark Fauber made a couple of weeks ago that I talked about at the time that I think is really important, is that I think the ultimate importance of Greece right now is not economic, it's geopolitical. And I think as we see them flirting more with talking about Russia and talking to Russia and basically forming a bit of a schism with Europe, I think Europe realizes that Greece's importance as a NATO member is much more important than any other factor here, which is probably why even if Greece somehow defaults on this debt, I think it will not be the expulsion of Greece. They're going to do whatever they have to do to keep Greece in the fold in terms of NATO as well as the Eurozone. So I really doubt this is ultimately going to lead to a Greek exit. And I don't think it's the economic ramifications of it that are the most important. But I mean, let's put on our thinking caps. If this did lead to some sort of Greek exit from the Eurozone, I think that would be devastating for the European Union institutionally. Again, it's not necessarily the economic effects of this, which would be primarily the Greece's burden to shoulder. But I think it would be the institutional black eye that the European Union project would get from that. We've seen in the past how Europe has done anything it can to avoid the perception that it is not a universally loved institution amongst Europeans, to the point where when they were trying to pass their constitution and that was getting voted down in various countries, they took that off the table and they replaced it with the Lisbon Treaty, which was the constitution in all but name. And when the Irish voters put a block to it, they basically just made the Irish vote again until you get it right. And eventually they did. And we saw what resulted in Ireland because of the happy confluence of European Union and Eurozone and Ireland and the disaster that took place there financially. So I think they're just going to basically do anything they can to keep Greece in the fold, because, again, it's not primarily economic. I think it's more institutional and in terms of political control.
I think part of the reason they are so determined to keep Greece on the hook and at least trying to pay the bill, I don't think they can ever pay the debt. I don't think it's possible. And the Greeks know it. They've admitted it. Well, look, we're bankrupt. Somebody, the European Central Bank should also, yeah, they're bankrupt. They can't pay. I mean, they're trying to squeeze blood out of a stone here. They don't have it. It's not going to be paid. You would think someone would just deal with that reality. I suspect, I'm just hypothetical. That's all this is speculation, conjecture. But I'm thinking, what happens if Greece actually defaults on its loans? And after a year, 18 months, 2 years, we find out that Greece is doing just fine. I mean, we saw it in a small example with Iceland, much smaller example. But Iceland defaulted on their loans back a few years ago. They went through a difficult 18 to 24 months, and they were back on their feet. And things were perhaps better than ever, in part because once they got rid of the debt, they were probably better candidates for borrowing money. People said, hey, they canceled all the rest of the debt. Now they can actually afford to pay whatever we lend to them. I think they had more access to capital after they essentially said, we're not paying. What happens if Greece just says we're not paying and the roof doesn't fall in? Will Spain or Portugal or any other nations be inclined to say, they got away with it, maybe we could do the same thing? Do you see what I'm saying? Is that the banks are saying, we got to hold you guys, you got to hold your feet to the fire because these debts are very important.
Right, yeah. To basically maintain the illusion that all of these austerity measures over the last several years have been so necessary to maintaining the structural integrity of the Eurozone. Yes, I certainly see the point. And I think, obviously, the big worry that has been talked about and written about ad nauseum is that if Greece fell, it would be the first domino and we'd see the other so-called pigs countries falling very quickly. So I think that's exactly what people have envisioned.
This domino theory is interesting, but why do we build our countries and our economies like dominoes? Shouldn't we build them more like a pyramid where they have a solid base, a little point up at the top, and they're not so unstable? Why do we have, someone's going to have to investigate why we have so many dominoes. Here's something we talked about. I think we touched on maybe last week, maybe before that. an article from Newsmax says the Fed can't grow our economy. The Federal Reserve lacks the tools to sufficiently grow our economy. What they're saying is the Federal Reserve can no longer rely on conventional tools, raising or lowering interest rates, controlling money supply, to move the economy. And there's implications here that are interesting. Another one is, here's one also from Newsmax. Bill Gross says stocks, bond bubbles to pop as the bull market ends. His description of what happens, he says, I sort of have a sense of an ending. Bill Gross, guy runs the business, billions of dollars. He is a multi-billionaire himself. This guy ought to understand what's going on in Wall Street. And all he can say is, I have a sort of a sense of an ending. He doesn't even know what's going on. And the third article is Goldman Sachs, entirely right about economic growth, Forbes magazine. And they're saying, they're coming out, or at least one of the employees of Goldman Sachs who's speaking, not necessarily on behalf of a corporation, but he is speaking as a corporate employee. And he's saying, look, this whole system is so bizarre, we don't understand what's going on. Right? That's the gist of this article. And the point to all of this, if no one is in control, if they don't have the tools to control, and they don't really understand what's going on, is anyone in control? That's the first question. And the second question, if they're not in control, are we on the verge of seeing a restored free market? Because the opposite of the free market is a manipulated market. If nobody's really manipulating, if they've lost their ability to really control and manipulate this economy, are we on the verge of seeing a free market restored?
That's an interesting thesis. I would have to say no, because I don't think a manipulated market or a free market is simply the opposite of a manipulated market. I mean, it depends what you mean by manipulated. I mean, if there's one thing to manipulate with intention, but there's another thing simply to manipulate and skew the markets by the very foundation of the market being a central bank that has the power to dictate the monetary supply itself. I mean, as long as that exists, you're not going to have free markets. So I think that the fundamental manipulation still exists, whether or not it works as a tool in a straightforward sense and people can really, you know, flick a switch and make a market go this way or that. But on that that note of people like Goldman Sachs and others trying to predict markets, it's interesting that they called for $30 oil before oil took a U-turn and started going back up and it had its little rally back up to around the $60 a barrel mark. And they were wrong about that. They called for the fact that the consumer spending would increase as a result of gas prices going down. Yep. They were wrong about that. And now they're saying, well, yes, we were wrong, but that's only because it's been deferred. The consumer spending is going to pick up a few months from now. But now gas prices are going back up. So they're probably going to have to come out in a few months and say, well, we were wrong about that too. Which I think goes to show it's not just that Goldman are inept. I think it's that economics is largely a pseudoscience. I mean, they like to pretend it's a science, but I think that it really, I mean, they'll come out and say, no matter what happens, oh yes, well, that's completely in line with what we would have expected, although we didn't predict it the time.
We're going to have to let it go at that, James. We're out of time. It does go pretty fast. I always enjoy these interviews. I thank you again for being on the program. Look forward to talking to you again on Wednesday night. Thursday during the daytime is when we will rebroadcast. Good night, folks. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back tomorrow on Financial Survival. I'm Alfred Adisk, and may the good Lord bless you, me, Frank, the producer, and James Corbett. Good night.